do the things that we do in religion? Why do we believe the things that we believe? And why do we treat certain things certain ways? What does the Bible teach about these things? I was making the point that often we have a situation where people may know the answer to the question of what we are to do. They've had this ingrained in them, but then sadly may not understand why. And that can happen. We think in terms of growth. We have to think about that. What standard am I being held to? Talked about Hebrews chapter 5 this morning in verse 12. When for the time you ought to be teachers. God knows the answer to that. What is my standard of myself? What should I know? How much should I know, and how much should I understand about why it's that way? So it's good for us to examine ourselves. That's what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 13:5. Examine yourselves whether you be in the faith. Sometimes it's not just a matter of being taught correctly about what we do. Sometimes we're challenged about the reason for it. Why do you do it that way? Or why do you not do it this other way? So that's our approach. And this morning we were continuing in a study related to the Bible itself. Why believe the Bible? You have to start there. And we went through some evidences matters this morning. But I want us to move on and look at some areas that relate to our work, and particularly as a local church, because this is where the differences are. This is what makes, in the areas we're going to study, these are the areas that differentiate churches, where you'll have differences that are intolerable to some people. Differences that are that serious. Some say, no, that becomes a matter of fellowship. Not just a matter of whether or not you eat meat or vegetables, like in Romans 14, where it has to do with an area where God has not regulated. God has not, He's not stipulated. He doesn't care. We're not talking about those areas. We're talking about where the Bible has taught something. Something has been said. So I want us to look at some areas that relate to this. And this really is a sermon that addresses part of, well, I don't want to say the name. One of the younger folks here at Parkway that was telling me a story about someone who had background in Churches of Christ, had been taught the truth on things, and then said, but I just think that we've been too strict on those things, and it really doesn't matter what we do. That is a growing trend. I have this discussion with people from time to time where you'll say, well, now, but wait a minute, this breaches the limitations that God has placed upon the local church, what the Bible authorizes and what it doesn't. And sometimes people say, well, I don't know that that's really that important. So this is the problem. We need to understand why we're doing what we're doing and why we don't do other things. For example, why support preachers directly? This has been controversial for many decades. Why support, if you're going to support gospel preachers as a local church, why do it directly and not through human agency, a human organization, or through another Church of Christ? Because these are the ways this is done quite often. Even when it comes to Churches of Christ, many Churches of Christ will fund organizations, another party, some other organization, a non-church organization, or they will fund another church in order for gospel preachers to be supported. This happens all the time. Happens, it's done by churches right here in this town. Churches do it. So why do we not do that? There are going to be some points we're going to be looking at now that fall under the heading of a Bible pattern on things. So I just want to mention that. We're going to be studying in concert with answering this question and several others. We're going to be emphasizing that there is a divine pattern. And that limits us. It reins us in so that we have to be careful about how we proceed. God uses patterns as guidelines, as limitations, to limit what we do. For example, if you go back into the Old Testament, you'll read about Noah in Genesis chapter 6 and verses 14 through 17. God had made the determination to bring an end to all life. It's interesting that I'm going here first, because this morning after class, well, something in a discussion I had with Isaac and David, David mentioned the breaking up of the earth's crust, and I said I almost included the verse in Genesis chapter 7 that talks about that, because people look for explanations about the earth's strata. Why do you see it not level? Why do you have places like that where it looks like it was broken up from underneath, pushed up, and it now is on angles? You see this where they cut through for highway work, and it becomes very obvious those are not level. Why is that? Because of what happened with the flood many, many thousands of years ago. But in Genesis chapter 6, at that time when God determined he was going to flood the world with water, he determined he was going to save Noah and his wife, his three sons and their wives. Now, how would he do this? How would he save those who were called in the New Testament righteous people? He would save them by having Noah build an ark. Built an ark, Hebrews 11:7 says, to the saving of his household. Now, how would he do that? What method did God use to instruct Noah how to build an ark? Did he say, Noah, build something that will float. Make a box. Make an ark. Or could have been a boat, but it was a box. He could have said that and that'd be it. He could have said, now you're going to need this to float for a while. He could have told him some things like that. But God had a pattern in mind. He had designed this, and gave the pattern to Noah. He said, now here's how you're to do this. Now, I say this because people constantly say, well, God doesn't care how we do it. He just wants us to do it. When it comes to supportive preachers, I have heard people say that. People have told me that. God doesn't care how we do it. He just wants people saved. Well, but what is the definition of saved? The definition of saved is always saved God's way. So we need to keep that in mind. God is concerned about, and people who are going to be saved need to be concerned about God's way and what's being done. We all need to be concerned about that. Here was God's way. God said, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. He was specific with regard to the type of wood that Noah was to use. Make rooms in the ark. Cover it inside and outside with pitch. This is how you're to make it. This is how you are to make it. Notice the pattern here. He said the length of it is to be 300 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, its height 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above, and set the door of the ark in its side. Make it with lower, second, and third decks. Very instructive and also very specific. This is what we would call a blueprint, a pattern. And God often teaches by patterns. I want you to notice, if you skip down in Genesis 6 to the last verse of the chapter, it actually says, thus did Noah according to all that God commanded. Patterns are to be respected. Humans are to respect divine patterns. And this is not the only time in the Bible that you see this. In Exodus chapter 25, God gave Moses a pattern for the tabernacle, for the furnishings of the tabernacle, for the arrangement of the furnishings of the tabernacle, for the things that were to be done with the furnishings of the tabernacle. All of those things you read about in Exodus chapter 25, 6, 7, 8. Exodus 25:8 says, and let them make me a sanctuary, a tabernacle, that I may dwell in their midst, exactly as I show you concerning the pattern. I think the tendency of But even people who consider themselves religious today is that, well, you're getting into the details there. I don't think God cares about those. People think that. They say things like that. If they don't say them, too many of them think them. Said, I want you to do this exactly as I show you. Exactly as I show you. What would faith do here? Faith would do what God said do. He said, for the tabernacle and of all its furniture, so shall you make it. And see that you make, later in verse 40, see that you make them after the pattern for them which is being shown you on the mountain. That is what I'm giving you. Make sure you follow the pattern. Follow the blueprint. Later, the temple is going to be built. Look at the language that you have in 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verses 10 and 11. David is telling Solomon what he is to do. Notice that he says, now the instructions are in the form of a pattern. God has given a pattern, and I'm passing that on to you. By the way, could God give instructions like this, even detailed instructions that involve exactness in practice, to someone and them repeat this to someone else and it still be divine pattern? Yes. That's what he did with David. David then passes this on to Solomon. Be careful now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it. Then David gave Solomon his son the plan. This word could be translated pattern. The pattern of the vestibule or of the temple, of its houses, its treasuries, its upper rooms, its inner chambers, and of the room for the mercy seat. Later in verse 12, he again used the word plan, according to the plan that I've given you. So we have examples in the Old Testament of patterns being used. When you get into the New Testament, this is exactly what you see with regard to many things. We just studied in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 5 recently, and we were talking about how it refers back to Moses. As Moses was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern shown you in the mount. That's emphasized. I always thought it was interesting that it says, as Moses. What's implied by that? As Moses. We are to respect the pattern as well. Our pattern. Well, what does the Bible teach when it comes to the question of supporting gospel preachers? The argument is made by a lot of people, well, it doesn't matter how you do it, because God's only concern is that people be taught. That's not God's only concern. God is concerned that people be taught. How careful are the type of people going to be in teaching the truth about the plan of salvation who don't care about what we're about to read here? What I've noticed is that people that disrespect truth in one area will also do it in another area. That's just human nature. It's just a matter of consistency and inconsistency. So I don't think what you're cultivating in people when you disregard God's pattern for how a thing is to be done is saving faith. I'm not judging anyone's motives who may have been taught by a system, by some program that is unscriptural. They may well have believed the truth. They may have greater faith than their teachers. That can happen. I'm sure that's happened, but the problem is that you're inculcating something in people's thinking by how you approach things. We need to be very careful about this. We need to act and walk by faith. Paul said, in 2 Corinthians 11, 8 and 9, I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you, you Corinthians. And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way. What is the Bible pattern? Well, we're seeing one of these pattern passages right here. What it teaches is that when a church was involved in supporting a gospel preacher, it was done directly by that church. It was not done through some other agency, some other organization, or some other church. It was done directly by the supporting church. That's all I know from this passage. Now, we're going to look at other verses. You could say, wait, is that the only way that preachers can be supported? No, if you wanted to talk about individual supporting preachers, Galatians 6:6 talks about that. Galatians 6:6 says, let him that is taught in the word communicate, have fellowship with, it's the word fellowship, koinonia, unto him that teaches in all good things. A person could pay someone for his work in teaching. There would be no sin committed in it. But we're studying about the work of the local church and limitations that God has placed upon the church. So one such passage is 2 Corinthians 11:8 and 9. Paul said this came directly from the church. Now, in Philippians chapter 2, verses 25 through 30, you'll see that the church selected messengers. It served kind of like a UPS, a FedEx, or a U.S. Postal Service. That carried the money. They made no decisions about the dispersion of the money. They were messengers. They carried the funds for the church. They answered to the church. We want to remember that. In Philippians chapter 4 and verses 15 and 16, Paul said, you Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, did you notice that we already read about Macedonia when Paul mentioned support while he was at Corinth? It's because the Philippian church was involved in supporting Paul. You Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me or had fellowship with me, it's koinonia, with me in giving and receiving except you only. Even in Thessalonica you sent once and again to my necessity or sent me help for my needs once and again. I think this is the ESV I used. So what does this passage teach? Well, that when a church was going to support a gospel preacher, they did it directly. They did not use a human, a third-party human institution, human organization like the American Christian Missionary Society. You know, that battle was fought back in the 1800s. Or some of these newer organizations that churches are using. They didn't use any other organization. No non-church organization and no other local church. Why? Why do we do it the way we do it? We do it the way we do it because of the New Testament pattern. We have only certain verses on this that tell us what we are to do, that show us how it is to be done. What about the question of church benevolence? A lot of young people, I've noticed, are having trouble answering this. Why is it not okay? They know what they've been taught. Non-institutional young people have been taught over the years that we don't give money to non-saints as a church. As individuals, we're at liberty to give money to non-saints. But as a church, we're not authorized to take money from the contribution or from the treasury, church treasury, and give it to non-Christians. Okay, why not? Well, that, you know, some people must think that's just what they do over there. That's just the way they do it, and other churches do it a different way, and so everybody's right in the matter. No, no. This goes back again to the pattern. What is the only thing we know? The only thing that we can conclude from the scriptures on this point? Well, if you look at the pattern, it's pretty easy. It's pretty clear. Why support only saints and not alien sinners or non-Christians? Why? Well, if you were to begin in Acts chapter 2, logical place to begin, because you begin to see benevolent needs in Acts chapter 2. Then you're going to see some things that jump out at you as to who was supported. Acts chapter 2 and verse 44. Now remember that verse 42 says, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, fellowship, and breaking of bread. Verse 44 says, all that believed were together and had all things common. So Who are we talking about here? Believers. Now, what type of believer are we talking about? Because somebody could say, yeah, they at least need to believe in God, but if they believe in God, we would be authorized to write them a check from the church treasury. No, it must be more than mere belief in God. What are we actually reading about here? Well, look at the context, verse 41. They that gladly received his word were baptized. These were baptized believers. But wait a minute, were they just only baptized believers? No, verse 38. They were penitent baptized believers. So we're talking about here, and in verse 42, were they only penitent baptized believers, or were they a little more than that? They were faithful, worshiping. They were worshiping baptized, penitent baptized believers, verse 42. There's a pretty big picture built here, painted here, of who we're dealing with in this context. So that when it said believers, there's a context for who he's talking about. Penitent baptized believers who were worshipers of God. Worshipping according to the pattern given in the New Testament for worship we'll need to look at later. Why do we worship the way we do? Why do we do that? Why do we only have, for example, on the first day of the week, singing of psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, prayer, teaching, giving, Lord's Supper? Why do we only do those things? Why can't we do more? Why can't we add some other things to those five? Because of the New Testament pattern. Because of the limitations that are placed upon us. That's why. But let's look at this. So in verse 44, it says, all that believed were together and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods and parted them to every man as every man had need. Some people say, but this says every man here. All men, every man. If you keep reading here, there's two more verses. They continuing daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. The Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. He's still talking about that same group of people that we read about in verse 41. That's the same group, the ones added unto them. He's still talking about that bunch of people. No, this is not just all alien sinners and haters of God and people that make fun of the notion of God and expect you to write them a check. This is not talking about those people. This is still talking about the believers. But notice that he said who had need. Now we're beginning to see a pattern here. So you have Christians, faithful Christians, but not just any faithful Christians who had needs. Flip over to chapter 4 and look at verse 32, beginning of Acts chapter 4. It says, and the multitude of them that believed. I don't have to spend minutes again defining this, because we're still in Jerusalem. We're still talking about the same group of people that we read about in verse 4. There are more of them by now. By the time you get to Acts chapter 4, there are more of them. But it's still penitent, baptized believers who were worshipers and servants of God. It's still that bunch. But problems are developing in the church at Jerusalem because of that massive influx of people who had come to Jerusalem, and so many thousands of them ended up becoming Christians and staying there learning. Staying there and worshiping together as the Jerusalem church. So verse 32, the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither said any of them that all of the things which they possessed were their own, but they had all things common. And with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. I mentioned this morning, this eyewitness matter. They were witnessing. Neither was there any among them that lacked. Now here's that need idea again. For as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the prices of the things that were sold and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. There's the pattern. These are believers, but among the believers, some of them had needs. They lacked food, other necessities of life possibly. The details are not given. It just says they had need. And so we have a pattern developing here. Look at Acts 6 in verses 1 through 4. This answers the question, why? And we need to be able to answer this. Not just what. Well, we don't do that here at Parkway. We don't give money from the treasury to people who are not Christians. Yeah, but why? Why not? Chapter 6 and verse 1 says, and in those days when the number of the disciples... Okay, what is the class of people here? We keep reading believers. They're called disciples. Same thing. Number of disciples was multiplied. There's just more of them. Again, I need to say that. There arose a murmuring of the Grecians against the Hebrews because their widows were neglected in the daily ministration. What's he talking about there? Then the 12 called the multitude of the disciples unto them and said, notice it's still the multitude of the disciples. These were Christians. They're going to be called Christians later in chapter 11 at Antioch. Disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. Acts 11, 26. So it says, they said, it is not reason that we should leave the word of God and serve tables. The apostles had a mission, a preaching mission. It had been given to them directly by Jesus. Said, now it's not reasonable that we should leave that mission that Christ gave to us and do what other people can do. The other people here weren't eyewitnesses of the risen Lord. The apostles were. Wherefore, brethren, look out among you seven men of honest report, full of the Holy Ghost and wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business, this work, but we will give ourselves continually to prayer and the ministry of the word. So what do you have here? A need for food. And who had the need? Women, widows, among the disciples. That's our pattern. Needy believers. In Acts 11, verse 28, just move along here. Different circumstance. You had a drought. Drought that came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar, verse 28. Then the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea, which also they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Who were the recipients? Brethren. All of the terms we're seeing are interchangeable. Believers, Acts 2 and 4. Disciples, Acts 6. And now here, brethren. They're all interchangeable. So you're talking about Christians. They'll be called Christians later. And they were in need. It's been rightly pointed out by brethren over the years. Wouldn't a drought affect all of the people in the region of the drought? The ones I'm familiar with do. Why didn't they send relief to the non-brethren? To the non-saints, the non-Christians? Because this is the Bible pattern on that. Individuals are free to help those who are not Christians, but this is the Bible pattern when it comes to the work of the church and benevolence. One of the clearest, I think, to me personally, and people do read differently and process things differently, I understand, but to me, the simplest passage in the New Testament that summarizes, and I sometimes use it to summarize all of the other verses, is Romans 15, 25 through 27. It is so extremely clear. By the way, we don't accept the accusations, derogatory, that people make that we hate orphans or that we hate widows. And when people say things like that, No, this is not a matter of hating anyone. It's a matter of loving everyone. The question is, how do you fulfill your responsibility of love? Preached on that this morning on the radio, dealing with adding to your faith love, the last provision of the virtues in 2 Peter chapter 1. Now, we understand that. That's not what this is about. This is about faith, the operation of faith. Are we going to walk by faith or not? So look at this. Paul says, but now I go to Jerusalem to minister unto the saints. What is the class of people? Now, granted, in Acts 2 and 4, they were called believers. In Acts 6, they were called disciples. In Acts 11, they were called brethren. And this time it says saints, but it's all the same thing. You're talking about Christians. Penitent, baptized believers who were worshipers of God. So, saints, for it's pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints. This is why I like this passage on this point. It teaches the same thing as all of the previous passages. It just does so in a more concise way. Poor saints, needy saints, which are at Jerusalem. It's pleased them verily, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister unto them in carnal things. Paul makes the argument that you people out here, you people scattered in Corinth or Macedonia, wherever you may be, you weren't impacted by what those brethren in Jerusalem went through. What happened to that Jerusalem? The drain, the strain it was placed upon the brethren at Jerusalem for accommodating an additional thousands of people, some say as many as 20,000 people, it would be difficult. So he said, you are a debtor in this matter. You've benefited from them spiritually. Now you can accommodate them physically. But notice who they were, poor saints. One other set of passages on this that are dealing with the same thing as what we're reading right here. Acts 11 was not dealing with just Jerusalem. When I preach full lessons on that, many of you have heard them, I point out that in Judea there were multiple churches of Christ. Lydda, Joppa, Jerusalem. There were several churches there. In fact, Paul uses the plural in Galatians 1:22 to refer to the churches of God in Judea. Keep that in mind. Churches, plural. So when it says they sent the funds to the elders, it never said, and no Bible has ever said, that they sent it to the elders of the Jerusalem church. Isn't it amazing how things become instilled? People will be talking and say, yeah, they sent it, the Antioch brethren sent it to the elders of the Jerusalem church. It doesn't say that, and no Bible says that. You can't find a Bible that says that. It says they sent it to Judea. It says they sent it to the elders in Judea. What's that talking about? That's talking about the fact that there were multiple churches of Christ in Judea, and they sent it to the elders of each respective church. That's the pattern. That's the pattern on that. We see the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. So these verses right here all relate to each other. They're all connected by being the same occasion and the same topic. Paul talks about giving. We're familiar with verses 1 and 2 of 1 Corinthians 16. But there was something, there was a need, a particular need that impacted their thinking on giving at this particular time. When I come, whomsoever you shall approve by your letters, 1 Corinthians 16:3, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. This passage lines up with Romans chapter 15, verses 25 and 26. But it also lines up with later when Paul had to write the Corinthians a second time, and we call it 2 Corinthians. He talked about the same thing. I want to know, he said saints in 1 Corinthians 16:3. What type of saints? Were these saints that just wanted bigger houses or they wanted newer things or things of that nature? Extravagances? No. So we need 2 Corinthians 8:4 and 14. mean, a whole chapter if we had time to go through it, but particularly these verses. Paul said, praying us with much entreaty that we should receive the gift and take upon us the ministering to the saints. Verse 14, verse 12 relates to the giving principle. Someone just asked me about this about a week ago. They asked me about this verse. I said, well, you can use it in a general application way. Paul's actually talking about here the work of the support of the Jerusalem church, benevolent work, but you can use it as a general principle. It's accepted according to what a man has and not according to what he has not. That is a general principle. Verse 13, for I mean not that other men be eased and you be burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may supply for what? Their what? Want. Their need. What type of Christians were these that you're helping? Needy Christians. Needy saints. And he said, for their want, and their abundance also may supply for your want, that there may be equality. And then in 2 Corinthians, in closing on this, 2 Corinthians 9:12, for the administration of this service not only supplies the want of the saints. There again, that's very concise. The want, the needs of the saints. In the New Testament, the pattern for church practiced benevolence. Not individually practiced. We don't have these restraints as individuals. And that's why people need to understand that passages like Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10 are not even talking about a local church. As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially those who are of the household of faith. That's talking to individuals who can be circumcised, if you read on a little further. That's talking to individuals. That's not talking to churches there. That's not talking about churches. These verses are talking about local church, local churches, and the work of benevolence practiced by local churches. This is why we do what we do. This is why we don't do what some other churches do. We can support the preaching of the gospel, but we need to do it the way the Bible teaches. And we do that here at Parkway, in sending money directly to the preacher in the field. Not sending it through some organization where they make judgments about how much each one should receive and where money should even go, what parts of the world. That's not their business. That's the business of the supporting church to determine that. And we don't do it through another church. You may say, well, we understand your point here about using some organization to do it, but we're sending it to the elders of our sister church over here, and then they take care of that. Well, you shouldn't do that. There's no authority for that. There's no Bible pattern for that. There's no example of that being done ever in the New Testament. We've read what we're to do. And the same, of course, is true when it comes to benevolence. Just respect the simple pattern. That involves faith. All of the people that we read about that dealt with those patterns were commended for doing so. You think about the commendation of Moses in the New Testament, of Noah in the New Testament, of David, a man after God's own heart. That says something to us. Could be that there's someone here this evening who's not a Christian. Do you know there's a pattern for salvation? There's a blueprint for it. You can go through the book of Acts and you can find a very clear pattern for what is to be done in order to be saved. It's consistent. You go from Acts chapter 2 and you read about conversions and you move on along and you see the same thing in Acts chapter 8. Actually, two examples of it there. Acts 9, Paul. Acts 10, Cornelius. Acts 16, two examples of it. You see the example of Lydia. Then also a little later, the Philippian jailer. Then in Acts 18, another example of it at Corinth. And it's a consistent pattern that you see for what is to be done to be saved. When you assemble it, it's faith and repentance, confession and baptism that result in the forgiveness of past sins. Then you see through the epistles a pattern. for conduct and behavior, for faithfulness and service to God. We should respect all of those. If there's someone here this evening who needs to obey the Lord, come forward as we stand and sing to encourage.
I want to be a warrior.